Big Bang, the cloud synthesis. I tried to convince you by this very, very simple calculation, which, however, was basically capturing all the essential ingredients which are needed to produce the correct result, is that definitely it's the Big Bang nuclear synthesis which is a preferred theory to predict the right abundance of light elements like helium or lithium or beryllium and so on. Of course, the lithium is off. And that's a big puzzle, and it's a question for you. So, of course, there's still a possibility that it's just simply not measured properly, and you know it's hiding somewhere in the universe. But another possibility that some new physics is needed to explain that. And I don't know if you looked at that PRL paper, which I recommended. But anyway, so BBN happened at approximately energies or temperatures, which are about 1 MeV, which was the radiation dominated era. And so we fused light elements like helium plus plus and other things here. So now what I would like to do today is I would like to move to much later events in the history of the universe. And so I would like to discuss part D, first look at CMB. And then, if you will have enough time, because I will do this very, very quickly, if you have enough time, we'll start dark matter. Okay, so now let's move to the times where the temperature is much, much smaller than 1 MeV, actually when the temperature is around electron volt, which is something like 5,000 Kelvin or something like that. And this already happens in matter-dominated era. Okay. And so at the time, we still have plasma, where we have protons, and then we have helium, plus plus, and other elements. And of course, we have electrons. And then in between, there's lots of gamma radiation everywhere. And of course, well, this is a plasma, and the plasma is charged. And so because of the presence of electromagnetic forces, the plasma is basically oscillating. So there's, you know, if you want, there's some attractions between the particles, and again, repulsions between the particles. And so there's characteristic oscillations of the charged plasma here. But what is important is that all particles here, particles, are non-relativistic. Okay. Neutrinos don't matter because they are already decoupled, and they just roam free in the universe. And the true is, and the same is true for dark matter if it exists. So dark matter is completely decoupled from this plasma and basically only creates some gravitational potential wells where this plasma is propagating.
Is there any estimation of when the decoupling of dark matter could have happened?
It was, I think I displayed it on the chart. Oh,
right.
So it's much, much earlier than BBN had to be.
Okay.
So, yeah. So this was much, much earlier. Okay. So now what happens and how the CMB is created, it's basically created in three steps, and only the last step is really something what we can really observe. So the first step was a combination of helium. So obviously helium has two protons and two neutrons, so to make it electrically neutral, you have to capture two electrons. And so indeed, this happens in two steps. So first, the temperatures are so low that you cannot ionize the helium anymore. So first you create helium just one plus, and then even that one captures another electron, and you create neutral helium. Okay, so this happens first at about temperature, just something like 5,000 Kelvin. And of course, it happens first because the ionization potential for helium is bigger than that for the hydrogen. Okay, so then you have recombination of hydrogen. So recombination of hydrogen, of course, equation is something like this. So basically, almost all electrons are captured by the free protons, and you create neutral hydrogen, and then you create these gammas here. And so to describe this process, actually, it's not very simple, and basically, you will do it in your homework using, again, equilibrium approach. But that really doesn't work because this is really non-equilibrium process. So really it goes one way and the equilibrium estimates are not very accurate, as you will see in your homework. But you will do it anyway. So so this is a non-equilibrium process. Non-equilibrium process. Which you will model can really count, but can model by Saha approximation as you will do in your homework. And so basically the idea is again the same thing. So you have to find in this equilibrium process, you have to find, you know, what is the right equation describing your decay of, let's say, free electrons as the universe expands. And then when the corresponding reaction here, actually the reaction rate drops below the Hubble expansion rate, then you say, well, there's a decoupling of electrons from this reaction, and this reaction basically stops. Okay, and then we have no electrons left. So there's a useful quantity, which is called Xe, and it's density of the free electrons, density of free electrons divided by the density of baryons. And you can say that basically you have turned all free protons into a hydrogen when this quantity is equal to some fraction. So let's say you will call that when Xe is 0.1. So let's say in 1 in 10 electrons is free. And so if this is the case, then you can calculate by using this equilibrium approximation that this happens at about 0.3 electron volts, or 3,600 Kelvin. And because cosmologists also like redshift, so this is approximately for the redshift, which was 1,320. Okay, so then you say that basically you have neutral hydrogen. So now you might think there's only a few electrons left. Basically, everything is now electrically neutral. I have, you know, hydrogen and I have these gammas. So at that point, actually, the photons should be able to roam free, and actually, we should be able to see them finally. Okay, before they just, you know, bump into electrons, bump into protons, bump into many other things, and so their travel distance is very, very small, so we cannot see anything. So before that, this is really dark ages. But after that, you might think, yeah, now actually all, you know, we have neutral hydrogen, so there shouldn't be any problem. But it's not actually entirely true. You still have some electrons which are free. And these electrons like to bump into photons. So photons and electrons each other, like each other. And so there is a Thomson scattering. And only when that actually doesn't happen anymore, you have the CMB actually kind of finally released. So photon decoupling happens after that. And so, although most electrons already eaten, protons, there's still some free, and so the remaining ones, okay, there's still interaction, well, the remaining photon and the remaining electrons still interact with my gamma, and so still I cannot see anything. Still, it's dark ages. Okay, and this is through the Thomson scattering. So that's something very, very trivial. You just take an electron, and you bump into gamma, and you get again an electron, and bump into gamma. But this is, you know, the cross section of this is really, really big. So even if you have only a few electrons, this is still happening. And so still you cannot see anything. Still, you know, the mean free path of a photon is very, very small. And so only after this reaction actually drops, then you can finally see those photons. Now this happens at T decoupling, which is approximately 0.27 electron volts. And that is 3,300 Kelvin. You can describe it in terms of this parameter Xe, is that you say, well, now I have only really, really small number of electrons, so you put another zero in between. So this happens for Xe, which is something like 0.01. And the redshift for that is 1,100.
What is happening to the photons that when from 0.1 to 0.01, they continue recombinating with protons?
Of course, yeah. So you know, most processes, all the processes, you know, happen, yeah. continue happening, right? So still, I'm changing electrons to neutral hydrogen, if you want, all the time. But you know, as a characteristic, you would say, well, if I have only one electron left out of 10, then I say, well, now I basically turn all electrons into neutral hydrogen. But it's still not true that at that time, actually, you can see, you know, photons coming to you, because they cannot, because the remaining electrons still bump into the photons a lot through this reaction. And so only once this reaction actually ceases, you can see the free photons. So really, what happens is this is your plasma, and then the electrons sort of do crazy things here, and the photons do crazy things here. And at this temperature, 3,300 Kelvin, suddenly photons do not find electrons anymore, and they just roam free. Okay. And so this is what you observe. So photons suddenly roam free. And in fact, most of them haven't scattered with anything else after this. Okay, so really, in some sense, this happens very, very quickly in time. And so it has a special name. It's called the surface of last scattering. So when they've lastly scattered with electrons, and then they are free to roam. Okay. So now, of course, if they are free to roam, then all they do is they just get redshifted through the gravitational redshift as the universe expands. Okay? So free and get redshifted. And so today you see them as CMB, and the temperature of these photons now is about 3 Kelvin. Other questions? So this is, you know, very, very briefly what's happening, and you will fill some details, calculational details in your homework into this picture. But it's really, I think what is important to realize that it's not just, you know, forming a neutral hydrogen, but it's really eating all the electrons, which is important, so that you release your CMB. Okay? So now, what you can observe, the CMB spectrum today, and so the CMB was predicted back in, I don't know, 30s, 40s, 50s, and then it was basically forgotten, and then basically it was discovered by a mistake or something which is not expected. So in 1964, Penzias and Wilson, they built a radio satellite, actually, which was meant to be employed for radio astronomy, and also, you know, as a communication satellite and stuff like that. But by, you know, by chance or by something, they actually discovered the CMB at the temperature around 3 Kelvin. Okay, and then of course they got a Nobel Prize for that. Prize, and that was later, probably 76 or something like that. Well, mid, well, 75, 76, something like that. They got a Nobel Prize for this. But they didn't mean to actually discover this. They didn't build a satellite to do that. There was another group, I think, at Princeton, where they were actually trying to build a satellite to measure these things, but they got scooped by these people. Okay? But you know, at the time when they really saw this, they were surprised. It was like a it was like a noise which they measured, and they didn't know what to do with it, right? And so it was like really discovered by chance. Anyway, so it's 1964, so what you really measure is the Planck spectrum here. So if you put an intensity here, and this is your frequency, what do you see? So this would be a black body spectrum. And so what they measured is really data like this. They couldn't measure for higher frequencies because the satellite is on the Earth, and actually the atmosphere shields these frequencies. So later on, this was completed by Kobe satellite. So this is Penzias and Wilson, these few points here, and then this can be completed by, it was completed much later by Kobe satellite. And it fits exactly the black body curve. Okay, so this is amazing. So you have really the black body intensity, which is like 2h nu cube, restoring all the units of c and h, and then 1 h nu kt minus 1. Okay, so this is what really is exactly observed, but there is a small caveat for this is that you observe in each direction, you look at each direction in the universe, you observe this black body spectrum, and it's exactly black body, but if you look at each direction, it has slightly different temperature. So we see perfect black body, however, slightly different of slightly different temperature, in various directions. But of course, the temperature doesn't change much, and so if I say that the average temperature is 2.7 Kelvin, then the fluctuations of this, so delta T, which is T minus T0 over T0, is of the order 10 to the minus 5. So you see 2.7 plus minus 10 to minus 5, depending on which direction you are looking. Okay. And so this is relatively recent measurement. So it's actually, yeah, like 90s. And so it's, yeah, you were probably born then. But anyway, okay, so it's not that old to know that there are these fluctuations in CMB. Okay, so now what you can do is, because you have basically a ball, you can decompose what you see on that ball. And so that's called multiple expansion. And so you can expand this delta t, which actually carries lots of information, as we shall see later on, in multiple moments. On the sphere, that means that I have delta t, which of course is a function of theta and phi on my sphere, on my celestial sphere, and I just expand that in terms of the spherical functions. So L 0 to infinity, M goes from minus L to L, as you know from your angular momentum stuff, and then ALM are coefficients of expansion, and these are my basic functions, spherical functions, epsilon, YLM of theta and phi. So these are the expansion coefficients. So it's like doing a Fourier series, where however, instead of e to ikx, I'm using these spherical functions here, epsilon LM. And so now if you measure exactly what this delta t looks like at for a given theta and phi, that of course translates into knowing what these coefficients are in my expansion. Okay? So we measure ALM, if you want. And so if you fix L, in some sense you fix the magnitude of angular momentum, you know that there is 2L plus 1 of those. So it's like I can have M, which goes from minus L to L, and 0. Okay? So fixed L, or fixed L, I have 2L plus 1 of these. So what is interesting is to see how really the angle theta is related to L. And so there is this approximate formula, is that if you want to know how big the angle is, you just take this thing here. So the angle on the sky theta is given by pi over L. So the smaller the L, you have bigger angles. Okay, so if you go L large, it's really, really tiny resolution on the sky. But for small L, you have the basic multiples, so it's really huge distances for small L. Okay, so now people measure these things ALM, but what they really plot is something which is rotational invariant. So you know that I can rotate my sky, and it shouldn't really matter. So what you should get is a rotational invariant information, and for that, you rather don't display ALM on its own, but you display CL, which is like a magnitude of a vector in this M space. Okay, so really what is observed or observation and what people plot is CL, which, you know, you sum over all possible M for given L. And this is given by 2L plus 1. And then you sum over M minus L to L, and then ALM square. And so if you think about this, ALM for SM runs from minus L to L. This is a vector of the dimension 2L plus 1, and it's just sum over the squares of these things. So it's really a magnitude of that vector in ALM space, in LM space. Okay, so this is what you measure, and this is what you plot, and it's called power spectrum. And it's a length of a vector in M space. So that's something which is rotationally invariant, if you want. Okay, so now how does it look like? It's this beautiful picture, which contains all of cosmology in some sense. So you put L here, and you put CL, and approximately it has several bumps, so it looks like this thing here. Okay, and so this is L equal to 2 and 50 and 500 and 1,000 and whatever. Okay, so this is how it looks like. And so these peaks, and so how they are high, how they are wide, and so on, it contains lots of information. And in fact, you can actually describe your universe by several parameters, which we will, which I will mention to you later on. But for example, one of them is, you know, how many baryons do we really have? So for example, omega b, which is like rho b over rho critical. So it's one of the parameters which describes our universe. It turns out that the universe is actually described by only 6 parameters. So one of them is omega b, and there are many others, which we will see later on. And so just tuning the value of these 6 parameters, actually, you can start plotting, you know, if I fix the values of these 6 parameters, I can start plotting how this CL spectrum will look like. Okay, and so that of course fixes what these parameters have to be in accordance with the observation what we observe the CL here. Okay, and it turns out that really only 6 parameters are needed. And that's actually surprising, and it's so it seems that the universe is very, very simple in some sense. And if you know these 6 parameters, you don't know everything. So now what is actually interesting is that there are some error bars into these pictures. So there's an error bar. But these error bars are not really connected with the observation itself, but rather, so this is called cosmic variance. Cosmic variance. But they're much more describing the fact that actually you are doing some kind of statistics on the universe, but you have only one. The universe actually happens only once. So you don't really have many statistical data. You have only one statistical data. So you are doing statistical analysis on a system with only one possible data. And that's the origin of this cosmic variance, and I'll discuss that, precisely what this means next week, when we discuss CMB in a little bit more detail. So anyway, so as L increases, these error bars are getting smaller and smaller. And so for large L, the cosmic variance is not really an obstruction, but for small L, it is. So unfortunately, it is the small L which actually where predictions of various theories actually happen. So for example, I have heard Ashtekar telling me that, telling in a conference that the quantum gravity now predicts that actually this thing should be different to whatever I'm plotting here. And it's much better in accordance with this cosmic variance. So let's say the data as we have it now, something like this. So there's a prediction that the quantum gravity will modify how this spectrum looks like for small L. However, all this is of course within this cosmic variance allowance. So yeah, you can say it's perfect. We have a prediction coming from quantum gravity, but actually there is no way to verify it because you are well within this cosmic variance allowance. Okay, so that's unfortunate and pity. But anyway, okay, so just notice that there's this cosmic variance. So could I get the screen, please? So it would be real shame not to show you the real data. So I'll show you now real data if this connects. Maybe. thank you. So basically, what I was plotting here, I'll now show you how it really looks like. So let me start with this picture. And of course, that's the picture of the antenna where the CMB was discovered in 64. And it's the radio antenna. And as I said, it was merely by mistake or by chance or whatever that it happened. And really, people who were building this to discover that were scooped. Okay, so now this is the precise measurement of the Planck spectrum, and really, so the green thing is predicted by theory, and you see how amazingly the data actually fit that thing here. So here you can see really what Panzias and Wilson could see. So they could measure, you know, these frequencies, and all this was shielded by atmosphere, so you had to go to the space to actually measure that, and so it was measured by COBE satellite. And this, and again, you see how amazingly it fits the blackbody spectrum for each direction. Okay, so now this is the CMB map as the latest experiment shows, and so you see that the resolution. How big is the resolution? So what is subtracted here is this 2.7 Kelvin that's subtracted as a background. It will be uniform, and now you see these teeny tiny fluctuations in temperature as you look different directions on the sphere. Okay, and so some, and of course what this tells you is, you know, how basically the plasma when the CMB was released was fluctuating at the time. So there were some, you know, changes in density of the plasma because, as I said, the plasma is oscillating all the time because of the charges and everything. And so the CMB basically captures what happened with the energy density at the time. And now we can see that encoded into this beautiful picture here. Yes?
How fast does that energy density change? Because I was wondering, like, if I look at the same angular position in the sky, let's say,
yeah.
I will always get the same temperature for the CMB?
At the moment, yes. But if you waited 1,000 years, it would be different.
Okay.
Yes. But it's not that it would be fluctuating that fast that you could see it changing. No, you cannot see it changing. Okay, so now this is how this measurement was improved. So the first measurements, you see that basically no resolution here, but now WMA map, MAP map was much better here, and this is what we see by Planck satellite, and that's the latest measurement. And basically, you cannot learn anything new about the CMB really after this measurement. So everything that is to be learned from CMB regarding the temperature, it's enough, and it's perfectly captured by this Planck data here. As we will see next week, it's not only, of course, photons coming to you, they don't only have temperature, but they also have polarization. And so there's still some things to learn from polarization as well. And we will discuss that next week. But at this point, we just do the temperature, just to make this simple. Okay, so now here is the exact power spectrum. And you see the red thing, which is precisely the variance we have here, and the exact data, and then these are really observational mistakes. But anyway, so you have this one big peak, and then you drop down, and you have smaller peak, and you go down. And of course, the best way to remember these things, so see, so this is L, And then people display not only CL, but they put some weight to it. So they put L times L plus 1 CL and then something like that. But basically, it's CL. So now the way how to remember this graph is, of course, everybody attended some seminar at some point. And this is how you should remember. So everybody has a peak here. They think they understood something from the seminar. But of course, it's not so. And so there's a confusion prop. And then again, you think there's maybe something interesting for you, but then you are drowned in details. And then now it's almost over, right? But it never ends. There's so many questions. You have no interest to you, and so on. And of course, there is a question whether there will be coffee in. So this is the way how you should remember the power spectrum graph. So you see it's precisely how it describes the thing. Okay, well, thank you so much. Can I get it up again? Are there any questions regarding this first encounter of CMB? Yes?
Are the multiple moments above L equals 1000 not so interesting?
Oh, they are interesting, but they are just, you need great resolution. But it turns out, that 6 parameters good enough to describe all the other ones. So you don't expect anything new to happen there, I think.
Can you comment on the thing you said about if we measure it more precisely, there's nothing more to learn?
I will do it in detail next week. So wait, please. So next week, so I'll explain what precisely you mean by this, doing statistics on one data ensemble. I'll explain what I mean by that. Mm. And I'll also explain, precisely what I mean by this cosmic variance and why it happens for small L and not for big L. But basically, the simple answer is that you know that for small L, so there's this 2L plus 1 data for fixed L. Okay, so if you go small and smaller L, there's less and less thing which contribute here. So for small L, it's only a small number of these ALMs which contribute, and that's why there's like huge mistake in some sense. So if you go to higher and higher L, there's many more data, many more ALMs, and that's why it's much smaller. So you can understand it in this way. But I'll return back to this next week. Okay, other questions? So we have 20 minutes, so I can start dark matter. And again, I will not be very detailed here. And there is a whole course on dark matter still, I think, in explorations on particle physics. So if you are interested in dark matter, just attend that course. I'll just give you the basic observational data why we think there might be dark matter. And also, I will tell you what are the leading proposals for what this dark matter might be. But basically giving you no more details on this. So you can tell, you can understand my explanation here as a bedtime story. So before you go to bed, so just to learn something, but not really. Okay, so far, E, dark matter. So the question is, why we think there is dark matter. And, that something is fishy, people already knew, surprisingly, back in the 30s of the last century. So already in the 1930s, and it was the astrophysicist Fritz Zwicky. And so he looked at the cluster of galaxies, looked cluster of galaxies. So these are strange objects in the universe. So, okay, and so basically you have like various galaxies here. And the average distance between these galaxies is, let's say, R. But these galaxies, of course, move. And the average velocity is V, so move with velocity V. And let's say there is n of them. So we have n of these. Okay, so you have, you know, very, very strange system, self-gravitating system, where you have these objects. You can think about it as objects, and so there's one object, another object, and they randomly move under influence of gravity, if you want. And the average velocity, how they move, is v, and the average distance in between these objects is r. Okay, so then what you can do is you can estimate how much energy, kinetic energy, is hiding in the system. And so it's 1/2. So the average mass of these objects is m. So each of them has mass m. So the kinetic energy is just 1/2. We have n of these objects and m v square. So that's the kinetic energy of the system. And then you can have a potential energy of the system. And that is, if we have n objects, you can form n over 2 pairs. And then each of them has this, well, potential energy between the two objects. There's a sum over that. It's n times n minus 1 over 2. OK. So that's the kinetic energy. That's the potential energy. Now we open Landau and Lifshitz, and you read about self-gravitating systems, and then you suddenly arrive at a nice chapter just called Virial Theorem. And that's some theorem which tells you how, in average, the kinetic energy has to be related to a potential energy for such systems, and it can be derived by some just scaling properties of the kinetic and potential energy. Beautiful chapter, just I encourage you. It's called Virial Theorem. Open Landau and Lifshitz, the first book, and you will read it. So anyway, so what it says, that in average, the average kinetic energy must be equal to minus the potential energy divided by 2. Okay, so now let's use that. So we have 1/2 mv square equals to minus n times n minus 1 divided by 2 gm square over r. So now let's solve this for the total mass m. Also, okay, so let's solve it first for small m. So we have m square here, 1 n is gone, 1/2 is gone, and then I forgot minus 1/2, did I? So it's plus 1/2 still here. Okay, so small m from here, small m should be something like 2r v square divided by g newton. Okay, so now you may be interested in what is the total mass in these systems. So the total mass big M, so we have n objects. Sorry, there's still n minus 1 somewhere hiding. There's n minus 1 here. Okay, so the total mass is n times small m. So now you say there is many of these objects, and indeed there is, you know, in this cluster of galaxies, n is very large. So you say that n and n minus 1 is approximately the same thing. So anyway, so what you get approximately is 2r v square over g newton. Okay. So of course you measure all these quantities. So you can measure what the average distance is, and you can measure what the average velocity is. And so you can estimate how much mass is in this cluster of galaxies. Okay? And so if you estimate that, you find a very surprising result, is that the total mass, as predicted by Newton's theory, is actually 10 times bigger than the mass of the object which you observe. So it's the luminous mass, so you know, how much mass is producing light, basically. So in other words, there seems to be 10 times more mass than hiding in stars. Yes?
Shouldn't there still be a 1 over n on the right-hand side?
Because
you have like 2 factors of n, right?
I have n here, I have n there. So that cancel, and then I have n minus 1, which is here. I didn't write it first, but sorry for that.
This is
a different n. So this is g Newton,
okay, yeah.
And that is n minus 1, and then I'm saying n minus 1 is something like n.
Yeah.
Thanks. Sorry for that g Newton. I should just write g. Anyway, so it seems that really there is much more mass than you can actually see. And so that was the first indication that maybe there is some matter which is actually hiding and which is not luminous matter, if you want. It's not the matter which is hiding in the stars. It's something which is hiding beyond the stars. Okay?
Yeah, I have a question, dude.
Yeah?
But like, so if you're using this n to express big M in terms of little m and n, how is that valid if there is like some cloud or some like fluid of dark matter and then some like particles of that are stars like or galaxies, sorry.
So this argument is purely gravitational, right? So what I'm saying is that.
But it only works for like point particles, and you're saying that like there's only galaxies in the cluster, and so you're saying that like little m is the mass of the galaxy and n is how many.
Yeah.
Galaxies are.
Yes.
But, like.
No, but it's, you know, it's a coarse grained gravitational object, right? So it doesn't matter if it's just particles or I can treat the whole galaxy. The whole galaxy always is held by gravitational, you know, pool of its own. So you can sort of treat it as an independent object, which is subject to gravitational force of the other galaxies. So of course, you know, the pool of the stars in the galaxy is much bigger, so you cannot really start taking out the stars from that galaxy. Rather, the galaxy is sort of like fixed, and it's independent object, but that is subject to the gravitational force of the other galaxy. So you can make this coarse-grained argument that basically you treat the galaxies as point particles.
But then you'd also have to say that like the dark matter clumps come in like chunks as well that are.
Yeah, sure. That's a good point. Yeah. So this is only basically saying, yeah, there's probably more matter than I can see, but yeah. Okay. So this guy was actually puzzled by this, and he thought, well, he basically postulated there might be a dark matter. And he was a very good guy, so he even proposed how to measure this dark matter. And he said, you know, one of the possibilities, of course, at the time Einstein's gravity was already very well known, and so it was known that you have gravitational lensing. So what he proposed is that maybe I'm observing some very, very bright object in the sky, and maybe dark matter actually can get in my side of view. And so if the dark matter comes in front of the side of you, then actually there's a gravitational lensing of that light coming from that bright object. And so the bright object should be even brighter for some time. And so he suggested that maybe you can really observe dark matter by gravitational lensing. And this was sort of used later, much later, like 50 years later, where people really tried to discover dark matter by gravitational lensing, but as far as I know, by now there wasn't any success in doing that. So it's a nice and interesting method how you should be able to observe dark matter, but not really. People haven't been able. So anyway, so that was the first argument, and somehow people didn't take it seriously. But there's another argument in 1970s, but that was actually a time when people started believing in dark matter. And it was another person, Vera Rubin, and she studied galaxy rotation curves. So what it means, if you imagine a galaxy, looks something like this. Okay, so this is our galaxy. And of course, it's composed of stars, and it's very, very bright here, and then the light fades. But then if you actually prolong this arm here, then you have few struggling stars here. Few struggling stars. And so what she did is that she measured their velocities. Of course, everything, you know, sort of rotates and you know, moves on the... So there's a gravitational pull, but there's also a centrifugal force. And so she measured the velocity of these struggling stars, which are very, very far from the center of that galaxy. And again, you can use Kepler's or Newton's argument, Kepler's law. So you know that if you had spherically symmetric potential, you would have G m at a distance of r, so how much mass is contained at a given radius r inside, divided by r square, is equal to V over r, which is the centrifugal force. Okay. So that means that if there is no more matter, well, if you contain all the matter, so let's say I circle around all the matter here, then m is a constant. So you just included all the matter inside, and this m of r becomes a constant. So outside of matter, we have m equal to constant. Basically, you included all possible matter inside the galaxy. So m is a constant, which means that the velocity of these stars should be proportional to, so now, 1 over square root of r. Okay? Why is it twice a v square? Sorry for that. That wouldn't work. So now it works. Okay? So v must behave like that if you include all the matter of the galaxy. So in other words, if you plot a curve, this is the radius, how you go far away from the galaxy, and what is the velocity of these stars. So you should have, so as m increases, well, the velocity can increase, but once you include all the matter, then it should start decreasing as 1 square root of r here. So this is r visible light. So you think now you have included all the matter which is contained in that galaxy, and you know after that there shouldn't be any more matter, so you should follow this 1 over square root of r law. Okay, so this is what you should observe. However, there's a theoretical prediction by Newton's theory, but what is actually observed is this. So what it means is actually there is much more matter hiding later on. So even if you don't see any matter here, there still must be some because of this Kepler's law. Okay.
GR doesn't introduce much corrections. Like
no.
For all this, it's okay to use Newton.
In some sense. So the only thing which, you know, may trouble you is that we are using sort of like spherical symmetric ansatz here.
Yeah.
And you know that GR for spherical symmetry is exactly the same as Newton in some sense.
Yeah.
You know, there's a Schwarzschild solution, looks like Newton.
So, but the corrections of 1 over R cubed. Like,
it doesn't help. So the Newtonian argument is perfectly valid here, and GR doesn't solve this problem. So again, so that means that even at these radii here, there must be extra matter. Okay, so very good. Let me finish with one more puzzle for you. So yeah, there must be extra matter in these galaxies. There must be extra matter in these clusters. And so the first thing you may think about is, well, this matter is simply there. It's maybe not so bright star, so maybe it's, you know, something which is not shining enough. But it could be just normal baryons, right? It could be just protons or whatever, but they are just not heated enough so that we can see them. But you can very easily show that actually the dark matter cannot be baryons. So dark matter is not baryons. And because I have only 2 minutes, I'll just give you the first argument. So one way to see this is that you recall that we discussed this Big Bang nucleosynthesis in some detail, and we know that BBN really depends, the predictions of BBN depends on the value of eta, which is this number of baryons, the number of photons. And we know that this is something like 10 to minus 9. So now, of course, this number is approximately conserved throughout the history of the universe. The reason for that is, well, so after the BBN, well, okay, so this is conserved in time. So the value 10 to the minus 9 is measured now, but because this is you know, conserved in time, the same value 10 to the minus 9 had to be true during BBN. Okay. So we know and gamma today and baryon today. Sorry, I revised the logic. So we know that at BBN it has the value 10 to minus 9. Because that's you know, that gives the right amount of helium, that gives the right amount of deuterium and stuff like that. So we know that at BBN time it was 10 to minus 9. It was conserved in time, and that means the same ratio has to be today. So now this is what you observe, and this is what you can read. Okay, so you know how many baryons are there today. And you can show that all the baryons can show that all the baryons are basically the shining matter. Okay, so let me say that again. So we know from BBN the value of eta. If you start changing eta, the BBN will completely give different prediction. You know that it must be conserved in time. Because it's conserved in time, it has the same value. Now you can measure how many photons are there. Well, you know the photon density. That's why you know this density here. And so you know how many baryons are in the universe today. If you know how many baryons are there today, you can compare this with, you know, the number of baryons you see in shining stars. Okay, and they exactly match. So there is no extra baryons hiding somewhere. That cannot be, because you would screw up the BBN nucleosynthesis. Okay, So dark matter is not baryons. I'll give you another argument tomorrow, which however will be less clear than this one.
And what about the missing baryon problem?
What do you mean missing?
Yeah, like do you think that the number of baryons doesn't match? We have one more than.
Oh no no. Okay, so you know that's the origin of this eta, right? So yeah, so basically you know that this eta is 10^-9.
Okay.
So that means, you know, where does this number come from? Why do we have 10^9 more photons than baryons? And of course, the simplest explanation is that, you know, the baryons and antibaryons annihilated, and they produce lots of these gamma things, right? And so only some of baryons were left, and so that's, you know, the remaining baryons. So this 10^-9 comes from the fact that you had 10^+1 baryon more than antibaryon. Okay, so that's a question. Why this is 10^-9? But you know that happened very, very early in the universe. But now this 10^-9 is constrained by this BBN thing. Okay. Other question. Okay.
Tomorrow more dark matter.